Welcome to Taboo Topic. I am your host,
Andrew, and we are back for another edition of Taboo Topic. Before I get going, I need to make a slight correction that I made last week. I said last week when we spoke with Tony Garcia that it was the 100th edition of Taboo Topic. I was wrong. I don't know why I thought it was a 100th episode, but we're definitely not in the 100th episode. We're like, even with this episode, we're still like a couple short of 100. So, with that said, that was not the 100th edition. This is not the 100th edition as well. I apologize for that. My memory, for some reason, told me it was the 100th. So anyways, we are back with another edition of Taboo Topic. And as I promised, there is another co-host part of this rotation now that we're going to be producing two episodes a month. And that is my friend Mark. Mark Reimers, that's pronounced that right?
You got it.
Yep. And we met, again, another friend from church. And he actually used to be a journalist. But before I get going, I want to remind everyone to please remember to share this episode when you hear this episode and hit the like button. And also, please let me know how you guys are doing. And I hope y'all are having a great day. And with that said, Mark, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Although you already told everybody I used to be a journalist, now the audience is totally not on my side.
Well, in that case, let's give Mark a chance before we write him off immediately.
It's all good. No, it's self-depreciating humor is the survival mechanism for people that have worked in newspapers. So, no, I appreciate you having me on, Ken. This is kind of a cool thing for me. I haven't done something like this before. There was always sort of an interest in it on my end, but never really the opportunity with the way life goes. And obviously it's been about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years since I've been out of newspapers, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, closer to 9 years, never mind. But it's hard to believe. And I really appreciate the opportunity. I hope I'm already having fun. And I also think I was going to say, you should just tell every guest, this is our 100th episode. You're a special guest for this 100th episode, and see how long we can get that gag going.
Oh my gosh. I'm not sure I wanted to see my audience. Oh my gosh. But yeah, you were the journalist of the Bradenton newspaper. Is that correct?
No. We go way back. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so Northwest Washington. I was a student journalist up there when I went to college, and then upon graduating, I got to work in my own community up there at a weekly paper. Actually, a family of weekly papers, I should say, and which was nice because, you know, one of the most important things about writing is that you need to know your audience, and it was really sort of one of those keys that unlocked it for me after being a little skeptical all the way through college about whether this was for me. But as soon as I felt a little bit more of a connection to my community up there in a small town called Linden, Washington, mm-hmm. It was really a lot easier. And so I spent about 7 years doing that, in that town, as well as in a neighboring town that also had a paper owned by the same company. So, had a lot of fun doing it. It sort of scratched the whole creative itch. And then I did my best to escape it for the last half of my time there. But, you know, retooling and coming out of the recession as it was a little bit of a difficult road to find sort of a way out of it, I should say.
With Tony last week, I want people to really get an idea of who you are, and I think that's a great way to start talking about how really you started in journalism, which is pretty neat. So what was your last gig then? Was that the one I remember you like used to writing for the local newspaper here in Bradenton?
No, sorry. It's all good.
Okay.
We haven't had a long enough conversation already. We're sort of doing all the backgrounding right now. That's fine.
Ah, cool. So I'm learning as with the rest of the audience. Cool.
There you go. We'll see how this goes. I was already, journalism was already pretty much in my rearview mirror by the time I moved to Florida with my family in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in 2015 where I made the transition out of that. And so, yeah, the last role that I had was for the latter, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I was the editor of one of the smaller sister papers of the town where I grew, of the town where I grew up in. And so it was sort of a an all encompassing one man wrecking machine kind of role where, you know, if you know anything about weekly newspapers, this is very common. You have one person that has to sort of take the lead if it's a small enough newspaper. And, you know, they pretty much determine, you know, what the news hole is going to look like. If they're a part of a larger group of newspapers, they're going to borrow a lot of content, really. There's a lot of efficiencies there. They're going to try to make you work as smart as possible. And then you're really responsible for localizing as much as possible and creating those connections with the audience, with the readership.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not the readers that are paying the bills, right? It's the advertisers. So you're just trying to protect, you know, and maintain the readership so that, you know, it's worth something to sell to the advertisers. And so that was a very, very interesting, interesting role, just to sort of get to the point. I mean, you're always carrying the camera around, you know, you're taking most of your own photography. You know, you're going to try to make sure your front page at the very least reflects, you know, the most important things to the very local people there. But then you open it up and, you know, there's going to be sections that are more countywide and broader. Just like when you open up your daily paper and they might have a section with, you know, headlines that are more national and building out, you know, the AP wire, section that they just pull from because they don't have anything more to, they have to fill a space, you know? but you know, we had some really, really cool things that we were able to do while we were there. You know, our business beat, I think it was really good. We had a lot of special sections that targeted, you know, the local farming community, that we would contribute to, some really cool, you know, even more specialty things that we would do as sort of, you know, like quarterly sections, you know, home improvement, you know, where we'd feature some really cool local architecture. And, so you really, what happens is you get very broad based knowledge from people that know things as a specialty, and you never become the expert, but you end up knowing a lot about a lot of different things. And, that's really, I think, what's so addictive about that field is that you always end up knowing just a little bit. And it's not that hard to have a conversation on just about anything. So, you know, somebody, you know, we'll start a conversation about something and you can instantly relate to it because you've got a story associated with it, or, you know, you had a chance to have a really interesting conversation, which you had to distill into something that the public could understand. So, it was very, like I said, it was a creative itch you get to scratch. It was a bit of a drag, you know, lifestyle wise, because you have to, sort of manage your week. You know, it's not really about even what you get done in a day. It's really what you're able to accomplish in a week.
Yeah.
You know, we would have our news cycle start on a Wednesday after going to press and really just pace ourselves. If there's a city council meeting that we had to attend, you know, that was probably going to be right on deadline the day before we go to press. And so you're out late. We did all of our creative, you know, layout ourselves. You know, we had to put it on the page ourselves and just sort of know both the creative technical side of it, as well as the writing side and the hard news side of it. So, yeah, you end up knowing how to do a lot of random things that, you know, when you're talking to, say, somebody who is wanting to know if you're good at sales, or, you know, trying to interview for some other role, it was surprisingly difficult to sort of demonstrate that you had the raw tools to do a different job.
Mm-hmm.
Because people didn't really understand exactly what you did in that role. So I'm grateful that I was able to sort of batter my way out of it, because, you know, financially it was a complete dead end. It's just, you know, by then, I mean, by the time I left journalism, we were already pregnant with our youngest, which is our fourth. And it was just, it had been a long road of trial and error, trying to look for other roles that, you know, presented something of a future, because, you know, I was really already 7 years in. I was probably as far as I was going to go in that role.
On from journalism because of that factor, as far as you have another kid coming in, and also, you know, as far as financially, you've reached, like, you've already reached that peak.
I mean, it wasn't much of a peak, to be honest. So, I mean,
yeah,
you know, when I got my first full-time job, it was probably about 6 months before I got married. And, you know, I was the one I was a college graduate. The best you could say about it was the fact that I didn't have any debt. I managed to get through college, either working through it or with grants or scholarships.
Yeah.
Where'd
you graduate?
At Western Washington University. It's in Bellingham, Washington.
Washington State?
Washington. It's the only Washington, Ken. It really is. Now, if you don't know anything about Washington, this is what I'll say about it. We had the name before Washington, D.C., okay? It's just another historical tidbit you need to know. Okay. So,
look, yeah. Cool little fun fact.
The district was just the district until everybody wanted to name everything after Washington. So,
I see.
There you go. So yeah, Northwest Washington State, it's right up in the corner there, on the Canadian border. So I lived basically 5 minutes from the border my entire life.
Is that,
at least, yeah.
So is that, go ahead. So you pretty much grew up and went to school there and everything like that in the state of Washington?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my family moved there from California when I was about 4 years old.
Were you born in California?
I was.
Part of California.
See, I was listening to Tony last week, and I heard he is as well. So, I was from the Bay Area. My family is all from San Jose, and we got well enough out of there before everybody had $1 million of equity in their house to carry with them. So,
wow.
You know, it's a very interesting thing to think about when I think back to the timing of that migration and, you know, everything that sort of went into that and the reasons for it. But yeah, we ended up in Northwest Washington. I was one of seven. I am one of seven kids.
Whoa.
Grew up together. My mom had started homeschooling us. She was also a widow at that point. So, It was, there was a lot of dramatic things happening right in about 1987, 1988 with my family. And the end result is that we all moved up from San Jose to Linden, Washington. And that's where my mom raised us. She continued homeschooling us. And, you know, by the time I was sort of approaching college, that's when I started looking around for options based on the advice of some mentors at the time that really wanted to not see me sort of languish in indecision about what I was going to do with my life. So I'm grateful for that, because I had honestly no idea. Mm-hmm. Growing up fatherless, the biggest takeaway is that while I don't use that as some sort of crutch, it really was sort of an excuse to be very insecure and indecisive about, mm-hmm. you know, the direction of my life, and having somebody, you know, sort of take me by the scruff of my neck and and shake me a little bit and say, hey, you can do something, believe it or not. And, yeah. You know, journalism was sort of the first thing that I just decided to try, because I think ultimately what it boiled down to was I didn't know what else to do. And I was curious enough to basically wonder what it was like to know how to do it. if I can be very precise there. So, so that's how I ended up in that role.
Yeah, right now I'm going to school for more or less social sciences, and granted, there's really nothing you can do outside of the college world with that degree, but
right.
at the same time, I am now at that portion where I'm taking the electives, and everyone always tells me when you get to the electives, that's when college becomes more interesting, and I am starting to see that, and I'm starting to see the appeal of social sciences. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I'm not saying that because I've talked about on this show, like, I want to be a teacher when I get out or when I get done with college and everything like that. And possibly financial advisor at the moment. You know, I'm trying to find some direction myself right now. But right now, with the college portion, social sciences, I'm thinking about meeting up with my counselor and seeing, like, what job options are available with that degree or what can I do with that degree, because it's a really interesting field. I didn't think, like, there was much to it, because I'm from the conservative, you know, echo chamber, if you will. There's, you know, those degrees are useless. You can't do anything with those. Which it's probably mostly true, but I still want to see, like, that there's something out there too, because, you know, I have the degree, might as well use it if I do have it, kind of deal. So,
yeah, well, it's a good time. It's a good time, in the cycle of boom and bust and bubbles that, you know, I lump the college, the college industrial complex, in this right now, in terms of just, you know, the bubble associated with, you know, the 4-year degree. It's honestly being deflated in a big way in terms of the job market. Because, you know, that, you know, it's not in every industry, because there's plenty of them that are contracting, but, you know, overall, you know, the replacement of, you know, the boomers retiring and you know, what they represented in terms of the overall labor force is just your generation and the one coming after. I mean, there's nobody there. It's just not enough people. And it's the perfect time for a lot of industries to basically look at it. And this is the latest information that I have. A lot of them are just reconsidering the whole idea that you need a very specific degree to get it, to get into that. So the gatekeeping is sort of coming down. I think you can look at just about any degree if you already are almost completing it and say, this is not lumping me into one particular box. I'm not going to be constrained by this. All I've done is proven that I can accomplish something. And so I think you're right to think creatively about, you know, where you could go regardless of what degree you have. You know, anybody can get any degree and become an entrepreneur even, right? So
yeah.
you know, if that's the bug you have, you know, you can,
well, yeah, and
you
can
do it.
And I was going to say, even though the degree itself, there's not really not a whole lot you can do with it. I mean, just having that degree by itself opens up a lot more job opportunities, especially teaching in the state of Florida, which, granted, for my situation, I don't necessarily have to have a full college degree, ironically, now. When I moved back to the state, like, that was still a requirement, and then Ron DeSantis changed it to where you just have to have 60 college credits. But even then, like, if I want to do something like teach abroad, for example, they still require you to have a BA. But the thing is, like you said, they're not asking for anything specific. They just care that you have a BA in something. So it's like, well, might as well just stick with this degree then.
Well, I was a little bit of a sucker when I was, when I got about to my junior year and, you know, I had to sort of declare for a particular program, or when I transferred to Western from the community college, you know, it was sort of a make or break moment where I had to, if I was going to pursue journalism, if I was going to finish my degree in journalism, I had to just formally join the program. And, you know, I had a month or two where I sort of had to square it in my own mind, because, I didn't like what I was seeing on the student newspaper and the culture of the program. It was very,
was it liberal then too?
Well, I mean, that's a given.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of liberal. I mean, they were going through a transition of philosophy at the time.
Yeah.
I can explain more about that a little bit. But it really, I felt a little bit inclined. I was like, you know what? Honestly, I enjoy history. I enjoy even a little bit of English literature here and there, and, you know, things like that that I never really pursued.
Yeah.
Fully, because I was so invested in finishing. But I always knew that whenever I was taking some of those other courseworks that were just going to be either electives or wherever I could fit them in, you know, I was enjoying myself a lot more than busting my butt going to chase a stupid story that I didn't really care about, you know?
Right.
And So there was always a piece of me that, you know, kind of looked at that moment as a fork in a road where I could have probably pursued something a little bit more focused on my interests. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and the most I did was branch out and get a minor in political science. That's not anything unique because a lot of journalism majors are encouraged to minor in political science as if just like, well, you just need to know. It's like political science minor could be a lot of different things. For me, the coolest thing about it is I got to dabble in some, you know, political philosophy and some history,
mm-hmm.
Some geopolitics, which was fun, and really sort of shape. I was able to shape, you know, what I thought about some of those, you know, surface level issues based on historical context, the greater world context, and things like that, which I really appreciated. It was fun. It was challenging, mm-hmm. and you know, I feel like I got a lot out of that minor, in some ways, almost more than they intended to give me, and also maybe even more in terms of personal satisfaction than my journalism degree. So
I think if I do end up having like enough money, GI money, to get a minor, I'm torn between journalism and finance, something to do with finances as well, just because I do enjoy kind of digging into stories, mm-hmm. and or just, as I have stated on my show, question the narratives. So I'll investigate the narratives that the mainstream media will present and mm-hmm. figure out to see if there's how much merit. And most of the time, there's not a lot of merit in the narratives they present.
Right.
But
yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I would be very curious what you run into if you decided to formally pursue that, because I imagine it's very differentiated among different schools right now in terms of the philosophy
mm-hmm.
of the discipline that they present to you. And this is what I was alluding to earlier. By the time I got to my senior year, you know, you've got all of the heavy lifting done by then in terms of, you know, learning to do the reporting process.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden there was one or two people that had just sort of joined the program who were just off the wall, and surprisingly so. You know, you wouldn't even know it. One of them was an Army vet,
mm-hmm.
and he was the most progressive guy that I had ever encountered up to that point. And this was my senior year. You know, I encountered a lot of progressive professors, and this guy just he came out of left field, literally, and totally. He basically was out to reteach us everything we knew about journalism. Mm. And it was confusing. It was unsettling, because basically he came out and said, this church of objectivity that they've been telling you about, it's bunk. And, you know, if you're not willing to smash the patriarchy and, you know, deal with this,
oh wow,
this religious hegemony in America, you know, you have no business in journalism. It was just like, okay.
Oh, all right. Wow. That's wild. Well, yes. I want to get into them a little later as far as we'll get into your political views, but I'm also curious to hear you expand on just how much journalism has changed since you went to school for it. It sounds like the seeds were already being planted at that time, as far as what we're seeing now with journalism, where it's just basically propaganda pieces, in my opinion anyway, but apparently like you were like already seeing that to begin with, like even like what, during the 90s, I'm assuming.
Well, thankfully it wasn't that far back. This was early 2000s, mid 2000s.
Oh wow.
So right around 2007. Yeah, I graduated in 2007, so the 2 years before that is sort of the time frame to which I'm referring. You know, basically, you know, when you use the word propaganda, I'm not saying that there wasn't already a piece of that. I think anybody who grew up in the 90s knew that, you know, the liberal media, you know, it's like if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, you know, it's like it was already the popular foil of conservatism, right? So and it wasn't that hard because honestly, you know, even though, you know, objectivity and neutrality was sort of the popular god of journalism at the time. I mean, it was literally the church of objectivity. It was sort of propaganda in denial, right? Because one of the things you learn very early on is it isn't so much about how you cover a topic, it's what topics you cover. So, you know, you're editorializing by just choosing to write a story in some ways. And you can't really honestly disassociate yourself with your choices at that point and pretend like you're actually objective because you're making a call. You know, if a story, you know, catches your attention, it's because of who you are. And that was something that they sort of had in denial. And so the fun thing for me coming out of that is I got to see both of those positions and all of their glory and all of their problems. You know, the obvious problem, of course, is activist journalism. There were some problems with that, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, what was the problem with trying to be objective and neutral? Well, I mean, there's problems and there's assets, right? So, I mean, it's a two-edged sword. You absolutely gain a lot by people subscribing to the notion that they shouldn't be trying to tear people down with their work, that they're just supposed to be representing their community in some neutral way.
All right.
But, you know, that denial aspect that I'm referring to. So when I graduated and got to work within my own local community, I instantly realized that that doesn't work precisely the way that, you know, your journalism professor would expect in a small town. You're in a small town, you're going to actually do a much better job if people know you and you are a part of the community. You're not some non-entity that is afraid to even cast a vote because it might, you know, make me biased or something like that. You know, I mean, it was absurd by the time it sort of came crashing down to the levels to which, you know, journalists had this guilt complex about how, you know, visible they might be in the community.
Yeah, and I would say, I think it is fair to say that there's really no such thing as a quote unquote neutral position to take.
No, there isn't.
Even if it's like an objective piece, if you will, the objective piece is going to still have a bias, right? And
absolutely.
So it's like you said, just depends on the person really and who's writing it. If they have a more conservative background, then they're going to have a more conservative bias and vice versa. So in that sense, right, I agree. It sounds like with the act, what that professor was saying, like the whole notion of to just throw, you know, just toss out the window. It sounds like what I like to use this word a lot, but I think it's, I feel like it's pretty much true in a lot of senses as far as like, it seems to be an overcorrection to address like the denial portion of objectivity. As far as like, there's no such thing as, you know, neutrality, something along those lines.
Yeah. And, you know, I wish I could paint it as fairly as just being a correction because that presumes that it was trying to take on that particular error. What it was trying to take on wasn't the errors in journalism. It was really just trying to use journalism for ideology is really what it was. So, you know, in some ways it was, by default, correcting that issue, that denial complex, but that wasn't where it came from. I mean, really, it honestly was ideology first. It was hardcore. It had a name. It was called the Chicago School, I think, if I remember correctly, of journalism. And I mean, the language that they're just teaching us, like we were in some sort of boot camp. It was wild. It was really wild.
Your political beliefs. I know where you stand politically, but I think the audience can start to pick, and I think the audience can start to pick up where you stand. But I want you to go ahead and just kind of give the audience, you know, at least a general overview of where you are, your political journey, and also I will ask about the Iowa caucus and the Republican primary as well, because I'm curious about your take on that. But I'll let you have the floor on this one. But what are your views?
Okay. Boy, this is fraught, and you know, I've already alluded to my hesitancy about this. Not because I don't have opinions, you know that. Yeah. But you know, really, where do I start? First of all, I'm going to start off by just preemptively apologizing, because you know, the last thing that I would ever want to do is to sort of act like these things should get in the way of real relationships.
Right.
You know, when you hear me talking about you know, don't make anything an idol, you know, especially politics, which really easy to do. Mm-hmm. That's more of a practical admonition to myself and a reminder, because you know, I'll get off this podcast and, you know, log on to Twitter and instantly I sound like, you know, I'm losing my mind over something. So yeah, it's, this is why it's a little scary to even open my mouth at all. But
maybe then real quickly, then maybe you should explain like your faith and how it plays into your life. Why don't we start there instead, and then we can morph into like how it affects how you approach politics and view politics then.
Bless you, Ken. I appreciate you. So my faith background, I've discovered is somewhat unique in our world, and that is I grew up in a confessional church. So, you know, I'm confessionally reformed now. I was when I began life, and that's, you know, for a lot of people, even my age, I struggled to even find people that followed that path. You know, mm-hmm. I find myself, you know, on the verge of 40 here, and you know, there's a lot of people in my life now that are in the same boat, you know, same age group, and I talk to them and we have a lot in common, and then we get to this particular point. It's like, oh, where did you start your faith journey? You know, not at all close to where I was, you know. And you know, because there's a lot of people that were my age that were sort of becoming more serious about theology about the time I was coming of age. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they sort of come into my world where I sort of began. And so a lot of things that I took for granted growing up, you know, a lot of people were just discovering at the time that, you know, I was going to college and had a really cool Bible study at the time, you know, where, you know, we'd just be doing a Ligonier series with R.C. Sproul, you know, on a topic, whether it be the holiness of God or you know, covenant theology or something like that, and all of this is material that is just sort of second nature to me, and probably one of the most enriching experiences in that setting was to just hear the hunger mm-hmm. among my peers for something that I had clearly hadn't valued enough as much as I thought I was serious about it. Mm-hmm. So that being said, just to sort of rewind the tape a little bit, right about the time that we moved up from California, my grandfather was retiring from he had retired in recent years from his pastoral career, for lack of a better term. He pastored a single church for about 40 years mm-hmm. in San Jose that began as a sort of fundamental Baptist church plant.
Yeah.
You know, way back in whatever, the 50s or 60s or something like that.
Yeah.
And in good Baptist style, they sort of called him to that ministry before he was prepared by seminary or anything like that.
Yeah.
So while he was passionate about the ministry, he was also incredibly humble about, you know, and sort of in some ways insecure about his own credentials. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the way, he basically just started going back to school, mm-hmm. you know, on his own time. You know, he took classes whenever he could. He started learning from people that they later figure out were Reformed and some Presbyterians. And that really shaped a lot of his thinking, because, you know, simultaneously when he's studying biblical languages and he's learning from people that have this Reformed background.
Yeah.
And that started to affect his preaching. That started to affect how he was approaching ministry in this independent church.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first things he did was basically tell his elders about it, and being the humble man that he was, he just put himself at their disposal and said, "What should I do?" And they, they responded very graciously to him and said, "You can preach your conscience for a period of time, and then we'll decide." And they retained him.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed in the church. They basically sort of became a hybrid church in terms of, you know, what kind of viewpoints on baptism and other random topics that might arise when you're making a transition from being Baptist to Reformed. And they retained him. There were only a few families, I believe, that left over it.
Really?
Within that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly which took place before I even came on the scene. So my own father at the time wasn't a believer in infant baptism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we didn't get baptized as kids until he actually passed away. He gave his blessing to that, you know, before he died of brain cancer. He was absolutely going to let my mom, you know, follow her conscience on the matter. And, when my youngest sibling was born, shortly after he passed, you know, she was baptized as an infant. I have a vague recollection of being 3 or 4 years old and being up there and getting sprinkled. And it was just, you know, I was a covenant child at that point. Right. So, it wasn't long after that time period, everything sort of happening at once. You know, I referenced quite a few life altering events, whether it be the move or my dad passing or all of these things happening. We landed in a, what really amounted to a sort of a Dutch Reformed church up in Linden. Linden, if you probably haven't heard of it, but it's a small town. It's sort of been saturated by its Dutch immigrant roots.
Okay.
Now, they didn't found the town, but they sort of took it over at some point in the 20th century. And at some point in the 1980s, even, there was sort of this sort of chamber of commerce effort to sort of give the whole town a facelift and sort of a Dutch tourist theme.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything along Front Street and a different piece of town, there's, you know, it's like every other day, every other year, there was another development that had a windmill as a feature. You know, it's just everything about it sort of got a facelift over the course of a couple of decades, right about the time we moved.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Dutch town. That's what we called it. And it had the church heritage to back it up. You know, the Christian Reformed Church is from an early wave of Dutch immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the first, second, and third Christian Reformed Church in town, you know, and then all of the other half dozen split offs from generations past.
Yeah.
And the church that we joined had just been founded. It was actually a split off from the Christian Reformed denomination.
Mm.
And because that denomination was seeing a lot of unrest at the time from, you know, a lot of egalitarian viewpoints sort of taking hold and being tolerated. So this very small group of people had extracted themselves from the Christian Reformed Church. They were sort of one of the first ones to do it in the town.
Mm.
And this is all background. I wouldn't have really cared or mattered to me coming from outside.
Yeah.
But it did shape a lot of what, you know, I learned about growing up. You know, we were in a church where they'd preach the Heidelberg Catechism, which is, you know, one of the Reformed confessions.
All right.
You know, every evening, you know, they had catechetical preaching. So you'd be going systematically through the entire body of theology,
mm-hmm.
or at least practical doctrine,
right?
In the catechism, and you know, as a teenager, you'd be expected to attend catechism class and you know, memorize all of these answers, unless you had somebody teaching the class that really didn't care about memorization. But you know, it's a culture that went along with it. Frankly, a lot of people took, you know, the Reformed confessions for granted, and I went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I went to college and started really expanding my circle,
mm-hmm.
Where I realized just sort of how rare that was. And you know, I appreciate it. You know, that was I don't know if you know sort of the differences between, like, say, the Westminster Confession of Faith, you know, other historic documents, and the three forms of unity, which are more like, say, from the continent in terms of where they came from, the Belgic Confession, the Canons of Dort, you know, these things.
No, I guess I'm kind of like you in the sense of it's just now them starting to get have more appreciation for like those subjects, theology wise anyway. And so like now I'm trying to, like, I just bought Bible study tools of word translations, for example. Mm-hmm. There's just so much depth and knowledge that I didn't realize I was missing out on when I didn't take that stuff seriously, and I always kind of felt as though I was like, yeah, that's out of my league. I don't need to know that. I just need to know that Jesus loves me. The typical American Christian, I should say.
Well, you start down that road, it never ends. I mean, the more you know, the more you know how little you know, right? So yeah. It's just going to get more. It's just going to keep opening up to you more. Mm-hmm. And that's the cool thing about it, I think, is if you're really, if you come at it from the proper perspective that this is not just the pursuit of pure head knowledge, that's sort of the fountainhead of the pursuit is I'm dedicated here to knowing God. And that's where it starts. You know, it's in the name. I mean, what is theology? Mm-hmm. It's studying God. And how can you possibly claim to have a relationship, like, you know, the buzzwords of my decades were, mm-hmm. it's all about relationship. I'm just like, yeah, but relationship with whom? You know, right. That's sort of the question that theology needs to answer for people. And coming at it from that standpoint, it suddenly becomes very practical.
Well, don't ask the American Christian today also if what their religion or if they're religious, because they will freak out or pull their hair out as well. Because that's another thing too. I got saved at a Baptist church at 14 years old, and that was something that was right. Like, it's not religion, it's relationship.
Yep. And you heard it.
Yeah. And then just a few nights ago, I was just curious, and I looked into the word religion, the Greek translations dictionary I have now, and the word religion and religious has a totally different meaning than like how it was presented to me when I was a teenager, you know, coming into right. the faith. And I was like, well, shoot, if that's the case, then technically I am religious by that definition.
I've checked the boxes. Goodness.
Literally.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, you know, more often than not, you know, those battles over terms are, it becomes a little tired because everybody's just, they want to reinvent the jargon and claim that they've accomplished something when really all they're doing is just rehashing what is a historical debate over some random topic. And so, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of different, it seems like in every generation, there's somebody that wants to unchurch us somehow, you know, present something that's not structured in the way that historical Christianity has been. Mm-hmm. And of course, we don't look at it as some sort of monolithic, extracted thing where, you know, the established church is just an overlay of our faith. No, it is the proper context for our faith. Mm-hmm. And we do that because that is actually what the New Testament presents in the context of the Old Testament as well. So, you know, all of these things have their proper place. And, you know, when people sort of act like they're too hip, too cool for school, I guess, or you know, too hip for, you know, being called a religion, it just, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a bit of an eye glazing over moment.
Your theological view, your relationship with Christ, how do you apply that worldview into the political spectrum then? And how do you navigate issues from a Christian's perspective into these political realms to where you don't, as you said, don't idolize the political spectrum?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a wonderful, wonderful way of approaching it. And maybe not in the way that you might expect me to answer it, but, but when you apply what you understand about God and man, to the practical sphere, which is what I already alluded to as being its proper application, then you recognize that it does have a lot of bearing on politics. You know, first of all, who is God and who is man? Well, government is not God. All right. We answered that. And what is man? The Bible has a lot to say about that as well. And that's really where, you know, if you have a little bit of historical context, or if you've read John Locke or Hobbes or some of the political philosophy that is miles deep underneath all of the different, you know, stupid layers of politics today, you know, you start to see that there's some real, real connections about, you know, just the state of humanity. And, you know, if you understand man as being depraved, if you understand man as being a fallen creature, you recognize that these are all imperfect tools, and that in some ways, you know, what we do in the civil sphere and in politics is it's not irrelevant, but it has a purpose. It has an ordained purpose, obviously, as the Bible says clearly. You know, the sword being there not in vain, to restrain evil. You know, we understand that God's law has a restraining end as well. You know, if you understand, you know, the threefold purpose of the law, one of those is to restrain evil, you know, and so we see that role in government. And so what we believe about man has is a super relevant application there. And so, you know, you can come at it and you can look at some of these underlying political philosophies, which are really hard to sort out sometimes in the modern context, because, you know, people can claim, you know, a title. What does it mean to be liberal or conservative? You know, it is so far removed from coherent philosophy. And, you know, I could tell somebody that the best I can do is describe myself as a classical liberal, and they would have no idea what that means. You know, every single day I start to question even calling myself that, because, you know, somebody else will call themselves a classical liberal and it will be completely on its head from what I'm trying to describe.
Well, I'm assuming you're not talking about like how some people would describe Joe Rogan as a quote unquote classical liberal.
Well, I mean, it's a cousin of it, I imagine. But you know, there, you know, classical liberalism isn't nihilism or just right wing ideology. I mean, it really, the key is recognizing that there has to be a certain tension. The only reason that, you know, say that the political philosophers of our founding, you know, a guy like Thomas Jefferson or someone like that, you know, as much as they didn't get God right, they did tend to understand the, you know, human nature. And
which is ironic, and, because they were a product of the Enlightenment period, and that's when the Enlightenment period, that's when you started having people say, or philosophers say, that people are naturally good.
But, you know, I mean, that shows the limits of sort of people's sphere of experience. You know, they live in a time and a place where, you know, culture is saturated with a shared set of values. And when you sort of go along your merry way and presume that certain things are undeniable, what, you know, there are certain elements of that become irrelevant when you get to the point where, you know, nothing is assumed anymore. You know, nothing about our shared experience is a shared experience anymore. You know, when we are talking across the aisle, people don't even realize that they're speaking a different language. You know, I mean, it's a real sort of Tower of Babel moment where, you know, people will shout something about, you know, a social issue, pick a cultural, you know, issue. And, you know, they're not even speaking the same language anymore. And, you know, there's a certain amount of humility you have to have when it comes to the idea of classical liberalism, where you have a tolerance of other viewpoints. There's not as much top down. You're trying to sort of allow ideas to compete with each other. And yet it's basically self-destructive. Mm-hmm. If there isn't a floor, right? If there isn't a shared foundation of assumed values. Mm. So, you know, a guy like Joe Rogan, it's totally invisible to him, right? He just assumes you can be an outright atheist,
mm-hmm.
and not actually see a source for truth, right?
Right.
You know, that's not really classical liberalism as it was given to us.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people sort of reinterpret it and assume you can just keep going when the foundation has been stripped away and God's law is not actually honored.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't. I mean, it will fail.
Right.
But that's not an indictment on classical liberalism. That's just an indictment on every single philosophy of man.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a single one that is coherent without God as the lawgiver.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of, I think, exploring the limits of all of this. You know, you can claim that this one is going to serve us better than the next one in terms of an economic policy or a political philosophy or a structure of government. Everyone can work and everyone can fail.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real question is, how best do we love our neighbor and how best do we seek the peace of the city where we live? That's really what it comes down to.
So in that case, how do you, because I'm assuming if Florida were to have the Republican primaries in March, that you would be a registered Republican, you would probably go to the polls. I don't assume you're a registered Democrat, even though you call yourself a classical liberal. What are your current sentiments on the Republican primary, and what is your fast or rapid reaction to the Iowa caucus results?
Well, maybe it's a little too rapid. It's a little fresh. anybody who I've traded barbs with, and hopefully in good fun, knows that I despise Donald Trump. It is what it is. You know, I was a political nerd as a teenager. You know, like I said, I grew up on 90s talk radio, and that was just the water I swam in and the air that I breathed. So, you know, you recognize that time moves on. What people assume is a conservative value changes. And, you know, we are in a process of upheaval. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that it wouldn't have happened at some point, that because, you know, every 20 years, you know, party structures and bases do change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the platforms that make up certain parties change, they shift around.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is sort of organizational survival.
Yeah.
You know, people, organizations just sort of naturally want to continue. And in order to do that, if you have to expand or contract certain areas of the tent, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
That's what's going to happen. I think with a guy like Donald Trump, he's sort of he's sort of a judgment candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
meaning what?
Meaning, you scratch your head when you look at him because okay, so the character of King Jehu in the Old Testament has this sort of providential role to destroy evil,
mm-hmm.
and that's about all he did, right? He didn't then turn around and serve God,
right?
He then was likewise destroyed. For the own evil, the evil that he perpetrated. So he was judged for judging, you know? And,
mm-hmm.
so you sort of see without getting into some kind of, trap of trying to say, oh, this is all you know, we're in such a special time in history that, you know, the United States plays such a crucial role in the kingdom of God. No, it's just another piece of, you know, what is biblically represented as Babylon, mm-hmm. right? It's not, there is no sort of special thing about it, except as much as, you know, there are temporal blessings that happen when that naturally come out of a community of people that by and large honors God.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as that's the case, you can expect that there's going to be a natural consequence of temporal blessings.
Mm-hmm.
So coming at it from that perspective, I don't look at Trump as being some sort of special antichrist or, you know, some, you know, biblical figure for and against. He's just another representation, I think, of sin in the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think what it comes down to is it's not that he's just a flawed human. And I think he's, you know, in the 90s, we had this mantra in the Republican Party where that character matters.
Yeah. Tony talked about that last week.
Right. And you know, in a lot of different ways, I was a student of moral leadership,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the role that integrity plays in the practical sphere of leadership. And, you know, if you're also in the business community, understand integrity and transparency are also the keys to any team being successful in a very practical sense of the word. If there's no trust, there's no ability to accomplish any goal as a team or as a group of people. A leader can't lead without, he can't effectively lead without having that trust and showing integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, right? It's not going to be leadership mm-hmm. if he doesn't have that. So I think he's just a tool. I think he's just somebody who lacks integrity and is there to satisfy his own ego. And I think it's a miracle that we survived his first presidency, honestly.
Oh my gosh.
So,
well, we're going to have some strong disagreements on Donald Trump then.
That's fine. That's fine.
But it's good, though. We need to have that tension on the show as well. So
I already apologized to you.
You
already
did.
Apologized
yes,
at, the,
did.
At the beginning.
You did. Because I guess the whole mantra of character matters to me. If we were to talk about character matters, then we need to talk about the whole character, meaning what do they do behind closed doors as well, and not what they portray themselves as. And I think Donald Trump in here represents someone who, what you see is what you're going to get out of him versus someone.
I disagree. I disagree. I actually don't think you what you see is what you get. You know, he tries to claim that, or I think people project that on him, like somehow because he's willing to ruffle feathers, that represents some sort of emotional and intellectual honesty. And it's a false narrative. I mean, if you really want to look at everything that he didn't do anything that he said he would do. You know, I mean, I know you can go back and forth on certain things, but the reality is, the best that I can figure this out is, he's a super sensitive and insecure guy.
I would agree with that.
And that has real consequences. That means he's going to speak one thing to one person, just like the best of the politicians out there, and say another thing to another person.
I would agree.
I don't really think he's pro-life.
Well,
you know, he's had some great teleprompter speeches where people applauded, you know, at a March for Life or something like that. But then 2 seconds later, you know, he's criticizing somebody for passing legislation that was remarkably pro-life.
Sound like a DeSantis guy for some reason. That's just my hunch. Are you a DeSantis guy?
I don't know. I don't know why you would say that.
Just some similar talking points.
Right. But, you know, a lot of his base didn't come at it from me, right? A lot of his base actually survived as Trump supporters
mm-hmm.
During his presidency.
Yeah, well,
I didn't vote for him in 2016.
Yeah,
you know, and you can say that that maybe didn't matter because I was living in the state of Washington where my vote really didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some truth to that, you know, because there's a very real, there's a real ethical dilemma to wrestle with, you know, yeah. when people present you with what you see as two poison pills, and somehow it depends on you to choose one. And, you know, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, I moved to Florida and 2020 rolls around, and that was a bigger decision to make because at the end of the day, my vote could have a role.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately it did. And for full transparency, I did vote for him. So,
yeah.
But, you know,
yeah,
I think I'm sort of done doing that. You know, I don't have to be a Republican. So, yeah. You know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, he's never going to be president again. That's a given. I don't think my vote matters on that score anymore. Mm-hmm. Because they're, you know, if you break down the electorate and if you put any stock in sort of evaluating, you know, the broader electorate, not just based on what the candidate is, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, how do they describe themselves? Favorability ratings, you know, I mean, there you're talking about a significant chunk of people, specifically independents,
mm-hmm.
who are absolutely not ever going to vote for him. And that's hard. That's a hard pill to swallow, but it is self-evident. And what you've got there is two parties who historically for the last 20 years have been broken down thus. You have the Democrats, which have a larger body of actual card-carrying party members.
Mm.
Okay? So the Democratic Party for the last 20, 30 years has been actually larger on its face.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's our starting point. The Republican Party is smaller of actual people who describe themselves as Republicans.
All right.
The reason you have success in the Republican Party is that they managed to cobble together alliances between special interests.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chamber of Commerce would, you know, happily join forces with social conservatives mm-hmm. who, you know, cared about pro-life legislation. And then you had sort of the people in the middle that didn't care. They just wanted the party to win, and they were the so-called elites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, between those groups, then you had also people that would straddle it, that would sort of check most of those boxes. But a lot of those people that went to the polls and would vote Republican still would describe themselves as independents and would be open to being swung another way.
Mm-hmm.
So every time they had success, it wasn't necessarily a product of, you know, we grew our base. It wasn't the base that won those elections in many cases. It was the base coalescing around someone who managed to cobble together those different special interests effectively.
Well, I would agree with you on some of these points. I agree when it comes to Trump's sensitivity. There were times during his presidency, I wish he did not tweet, and there was times in his presidency where I was just like, why did you have the need to respond to a nobody, like on SNL, for example? So I agree with you there, and I would agree right. with you that ultimately the independent is the key to winning elections, I think, because they're literally the independents, they're the swing votes, right? Like if you're conservative right. or you're a diehard Republican and vice versa, you'll never vote for the other side. You don't have to necessarily worry about swinging those voters. You have to right. worry about swinging the independents, the one that can be swayed. And I think I saw in the Republican Iowa caucus, or it said the at least the independents that describe themselves as more moderate, liberal, they're the ones, I think they favored more towards DeSantis, I think, from what I saw in the exit polls from the Iowa caucus. That said, though, I think one of Donald Trump's strengths is, ironically, I think he's growing a big base in the minority community, which Republicans have not really had much success in recent, as far as in my lifetime anyway, they haven't really had much success, really since George W. Bush, where George Bush got like 40% of the Hispanic vote. So Trump's like the first one to actually to kind of break down that wall and to actually gain votes. So I think there's strength to Donald Trump in that sense. Where
is that a strength with Donald Trump, or is that just where the circumstances are leading us? So, you know, I look at that and I'm less like I really do believe a monkey could have run against Hillary Clinton, because that election was determined by who was hated the most. And, you know, and so when I look at that, you know, when I look at that, I'm like, you know, I'm to the right of Donald Trump on most issues, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's, I know, a little bit of a fraught attempt at trying to describe something that isn't always right and left. Right. So you're going to hear me get really frustrated with the so-called Never Trump crowd, which basically left the Republican Party during the Trump administration and founded groups like the Lincoln Project and, you know, the Bill Kristols of the world and you know, the Rick Wilsons and even the David Frenches and people like that, because basically they just completely, they were willing to basically cast aside the entire platform, which was really odd. I'm just like, I thought I was opposed to Donald Trump based on policy, and all they did was just focus on, well, it was just very weird. You know, it was strange, because, you know, they would start to get me on board by talking about his lack of character, and the lack of integrity. And, you know, if you read a book by Marvin Alosky, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but
I've heard about him.
Yeah. So a journalism professor, you know, basically ran a really cool organization called the World Journalism Institute for many years. You know, I believe he's a Reformed Christian, very, very intelligent man who wrote some very insightful books that sort of bring a lot of great historical context to political figures. And he wrote a book in the 90s called the American Leadership Tradition, which basically did a bunch of sort of profiles of significant American figures and how their theology and personal values actually did affect everything about their presidencies. And it's a remarkable one. It only went up to Clinton, of course, because that was the heyday of the Clinton years and everybody wanted to rag on him and his lack of personal values, right? So it had a great audience back then, but, you know, you try to hand that to somebody and say, now here's a chapter on Newt Gingrich. Now here's a chapter on, you know, all of the people you've been told you have to support. They burn it as being some, you know, tribalistic, you know, thing. And I, you know, when I look at that and, you know, I'm being shaped by works like that and loving that work. Initially, I'm inclined to love somebody for rejecting Trump just on those kind of issues, but then the vast majority of those people immediately shift to basically opposing every single policy prescription along with it, and you know, they're out there basically opposing tax reform. They're out there opposing, you know, cleaning up the government or actually draining the swamp or things like that, which, you know, I'm all on board with.
Just because it's Donald Trump, they're opposed.
Because it's Donald Trump, they literally say we should go vote for Biden. And I'm like,
I would say,
really?
I was going to say, and I think at that point, that's where I would say they've entered that threshold of making, ironically, idolatry, right? It's a different, I would say it's a different form of idolatry, in the sense of, like, you hate someone so much that you will literally oppose anything he does policy wise or says, even though, like,
right.
he is technically right, or it's a good policy. That right. is another form of idolatry. And so I think for me, right. when it comes to Donald Trump, like to kind of hit back on the character matters, I know you, I know your sentiments on Donald Trump, but when it comes to like the full character, like let's, you know, take someone like George W. Bush that lied about the weapons of mass destruction, for example, but, you know, he put out a good persona. He was a likable guy. And I think a lot of people were tired of that. And I think that was one of the reasons what made Donald Trump appealing was, well, he's a jacked up person. And I know I know from your perspective, like what you see is, you know, you disagree with the notion that what you see is what you're going to get out of him. But I do see him as someone who, well, he's a jerk. He really, and he's a type A personality. And I would rather have someone in office that I see for who he is, at least what I perceive him to be, and know that that's who he is, versus someone who puts on a good face and then behind closed doors, once they get into office, they put their own self-interest over the people. And I think Donald Trump, again, that's one of the main appeals to Donald Trump, was because a lot of people were tired of the debate, the politician. I mean, that's what a politician is, right? Like they
right
go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say it's sort of a cold comfort to know that at least you're not, he's not pretending to be nice.
Yeah.
at least he is actually a jerk. And
yeah.
Okay. Anyway, well, I will say, you know, I mean, if you, you know, you bring up the Bush years and frustration with that, and it's, you know, there's so much to mine there, and it's not always just about where the party is, because, you know, there were a lot of really damaging things that did come out of the Bush years, whether it be, you know, entitlement expansions, you know, basically these drivers of our debt. You may not look at, you know, the Bush years and say, well, at least he didn't add as much to the national debt as Obama. Well, actually, in some ways he did, and more, because he expanded, you know, he had that what is it? Medicare expansion, which, you know, that is the driver of our debt, is the entitlement spending, which basically is something that is unpaid for. And right. it only grows over time. Mm-hmm. So it was like basically not only just kicking the can down the road, it basically just it ensured that it was going to be a bigger can to kick down the road when we actually got down the road. And you know, that things like that, you know, on the actual policy side of things, there were a lot of serious problems. And foreign policy in some ways stands a little bit aside from domestic politics in the fact that, you know, it's bisection between, you know, opposing sides. It doesn't cut across the aisle the same way. So you can have somebody like Hillary Clinton and George W. Bush essentially being the exact same person when it comes to foreign policy, even though they would have radically different tax structures for the Chamber of Commerce, right? So, you know, a lot of that is almost in some ways completely separate, because you've got, you know, layers and layers of succeeding administrations that whose philosophy of foreign policy and trade agreements and things along those lines are a lot more interesting and diversified than people even realize. You know, so the whole nation building notion of the neoconservatives, you know, I mean, really what that was is foreign policy idealism, right? You may think that, oh, well, he's just a war hawk. Well, there might be someone else who supports a particular, you know, investing ourselves, our blood and treasure somewhere else, who isn't a neoconservative or an idealist like that. You might have somebody, you know, there's diversity of thought in there that people don't even realize in the news cycle when it's passing them by. You know, you may be,
looking at something like the Ukraine war, for example, and presume that the only reason we would ever actually be remotely involved on any level is just because we want to be nation building or, you know, make the world safe for democracy or what have you, whatever, yeah, you know, tribalistic language we've chosen in this generation.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I mean, you know, foreign policy realism,
mm-hmm,
is the opposite of that. And, you know, there's, yeah, that's probably a bridge too far for me to just jump into that whole topic. Yeah. So I'm going to just,
yeah, you're good.
I'm going to back off on that and
you're good,
and let you lead the charge.
I was going to say, like, I think when it comes to foreign policy, like, let's say Ukraine, for example, I think I definitely tend to be more of the early 20th century, like, isolationist, you know, stance on things. And
you're a brave person to even use that word.
Yeah, I will stand by that. And before, yep, Biden took office, the world was a much safer place. That's all I'm going to say on that as well. And I think as far as Ukraine, I think there's some other special interests involved that I'll not dive into, because then I'll start sounding like Alex Jones, which that's a whole other conversation by itself with Alex Jones. I think he's brought some good value. I think there's value to what he says sometimes.
I'm going to throw a comforting blanket over us that we could all agree on, is the level of corruption on every single side of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It is undeniable.
Yeah.
You know, you know, a lot of people try to make the case for a certain situation or a certain action. It's like, oh, we got to send a bunch of money to Ukraine because they're the good guys and they're fighting the bad guys. Just like, well, that's a total flattening of the situation. And a realist like me looks at that and is like, I'm not sending anything because they're a hero over there.
Yeah.
You know, I would need to have a very specific reason that is based in a historical moment,
mm-hmm,
and based on a realistic understanding of cause and effect in the broader world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's based for me, I know this may not be you, in the U.S. position since Bretton Woods and the Cold War. Now we're in a post-Cold War period where we're still sort of structurally involved as the same entity,
mm-hmm,
but it's all changing. It's all changing, right? I mean, we are literally backing away from the position of influence that we had, where we basically guaranteed world, you know, free trade,
mm-hmm,
around the world, which is basically just deglobalizing everything. So everybody's food sources is no longer able to come from the other side of the globe. You know, they have to localize.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the strengths, I think, of Trump's policies. That's just me. But I think when, after World War II, and this is my last point I'll make politically before we move on, but I think after World War II, we were so distraught at what took place, especially when it came to the nationalism that created or led to World War II, that we had to figure out new policies to prevent another scenario where we had the extreme nationalism that took place that led to that war. I think as a result of that, I think there was an overcorrection to where it almost is now, we're almost at a point now where the policies can sometimes actually fail to prioritize the needs of their own people in the nation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's more, mm-hmm, that's a strength of nationalism, where a more national stance would say, well, as much as I sympathize for the people in that certain country, we have our own issues here we need to take care of first before we can help anyone else. What about our needs?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, mm-hmm, so I think that was also a strength of the Donald Trump policies during his presidency, was I think he did kind of have more of that approach of what's in America's best interest, what's the American what helps the American out first over, say, a country like Germany or Ukraine, for example. But I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, no. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, philosophically, you know, like I said, as a realist, I don't have a different starting point in terms of the national interest being of ultimate importance, because, you know, some sort of perceived or real or perceived, I believe it's real in terms of our global role since World War II, it's, you still can't take that on and sacrifice your national interest. So, you know, if it was ever against our national interest to do anything, I still wouldn't have supported it. Right. Globalist or not. Right. So that's the key point where I think I absolutely agree. We don't have any business doing anything unless there is a clear identifiable interest that you can identify. It's difficult to make that case in our day and age because we are so removed. I think in some ways the inheritance that we have from our role in the world is almost invisible to people because they don't even realize what they have. You know, the fact that, you know, almost every single global shock that we encounter, whether it be economic or from wars, famines, and rumors and wars, you know, just to use, you know, eschatological language, you know, it's like we are so insulated from those things, and we will continue to be, you know, I mean, deglobalizing for us is a cakewalk. You know, we still have trading partners in the Western Hemisphere. You know, we still have places where we can, you know, improve the supply chain without having to turn to China. You know, as we uncouple and all these things are happening, and the fact that, you know, you are interested in these things in the deglobalization process and sort of come at it from that perspective of we need to take care of our own first, you know, that represents the broader sentiment. You know, the fact that that's in this conversation and not just in the halls of Congress, you know, represents part of that shift within the Republican Party even, right? So, you know, there are about five more hours that we could talk about basically in terms of, you know, fleshing out, you know, how we got to this point. You know, I try not to be just a disciple of one particular viewpoint or another. You know, I'm doing my best to not just be like, oh, I heard this person tell me this, therefore I know everything about it. Like, for example, I don't know if you know who Peter Zion is.
I do not.
Okay. Look him up on YouTube sometime if you can figure out how to spell his name.
Okay.
But, he's a geopolitical strategist, basically a consultant who, you know, usually is working with individual corporations to help them shape, you know, what industries they should be expanding into and all those types of things. But, you know, he's fun to listen to in that he usually is able to take on just about any topic and provide you with the historical context for it. You'd probably disagree with him on a lot of different areas, but he's really hard to argue with because he does provide a lot of that sort of Cold War Bretton Woods era context to what he says. So, but he can pick a country on the map and tell you what are the challenges of that particular country in their current historical context and, you know, project sort of what's going to happen to them in the next 10 years, so to speak. Right. So that's sort of his bread and butter. And, you know, he's sort of a guilty pleasure of mine, I will admit, but he's wrong on a few things. I acknowledge it, but, you know, he totally trips himself up when he talks about, like, say, domestic policy and understanding what social conservatism is. And, because if you had to describe him, he'd be a little bit more of like a Chamber of Commerce Republican. But just very knowledgeable. You know, between, you know, Peter Zion, Neil Ferguson as a historian, of sort of, you know, where we are as a historical empire, because that's really what you would have to call it definitionally. Those are some of the people that I would say that describe very well my understanding of where we are historically. So it's, I'm not out there, you know, getting my cues mostly from you know, commentators who are arguing in the political sphere. It's usually it's usually more of the broader context conversation that colors my political opinions.
Well, I'm glad that we are two different conservatives. It sounds like you and I are very different ideas of what conservatism looks like, and I guess you could say I represent more of that shift in conservatism.
Yep.
And I think that's fair to say, and you represent more of that from a different era too. But there's merit to both. I think there's definitely merit to both. There's definitely strengths and weaknesses to this shift and the old school way of thinking, I guess. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But
that's fine.
It's all good. But I think ultimately it kind of goes back to that idea of classical liberalism, as far as just like having that room of diversity of thought to have and have that dialogue, which honestly, I think I give credit to conservatives, no matter if you're a MAGA conservative or you're from like your character matters conservative. I think ultimately we do a good job of allowing diversity of thought to roam within our space. And I think that's something that has been lost on the other side, where you can't even say anything on the other side before they push you out. And then before we know it, they're kind of like, they're just kind of like politically homeless. That's the term that people describe themselves sometimes, and say, well, I'm not conservative, but I'm not a socialist either.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But anyhoot, so with that said, what is something that you look forward to being on this show? You know, what made you say yes to being one of the co-hosts, being part of this rotation?
Oh, man. You know, this is, you know, I said something earlier about my approach to journalism when I first considered it. Mm-hmm. Not the part about not knowing what to do, but, you know, the part about it being such a curiosity to me, something that I would like to know how to do, right? Mm-hmm. I would love to have done it and, you know, sort of scratch that creative itch, I guess. Mm-hmm. So this is something I just haven't had a chance to do. You know, there are certain areas of my creative life that, you know, are really superseded by family life. And, you know, you just, you know, you got to stay focused on the things that are a little bit higher up on the, excuse me, lower down on the mat. What is it? The hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole self-actualization being, you know, up at the top, you know, and rarely achieved. But, you know, this is sort of in that context. This is, I feel like, I guess this is me saying, expressing my gratitude for the opportunity. This is just very special, to be able to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, have the space and the interest of someone else to even pursue it and, put my mouth in front of a microphone and start talking and go on the record is also kind of scary. So, so I guess it must be worth doing. Right. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's new. It is something that I thought about for a long time, and, this is my first opportunity to do it. And, so I'm just really excited to see where it goes. I've thought about it in many ways. You know, there's other areas of my creative life that I dabble in. You know, our family was very musical growing up, and you know, I've had a chance to play around with some recording, but not really seriously for lack of equipment, but in my work context, which now is in philanthropy, among a bunch of senior citizens, in my spare time, I'm able to sort of volunteer as a music artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of one of those opportunities to do it, but not necessarily have to, put yourself out there without knowing what you're made of, so to speak. So in some ways this is sort of a similar venture. It's like, hey, I wonder how this works.
yeah.
So I really appreciate it. That's my goal, is to just kind of
see where it goes without putting my foot in
it. Oh, cool. So before we go, I want your prediction. When it comes to the Florida primary, will we even have a Florida primary? Or will there be another option besides Donald Trump on the ticket? What's your prediction?
I'm not even sure I would call it a prediction because if there's one thing I know about political science, it's not a science. and politics will politics. Even, you know, every special interest that thinks they have a hold on something mm-hmm. almost never gets what they want. So if I had to predict, I would say, I would say we still have a Florida primary.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a significant number of people, and not just the electorate, but actual influencers and active supporters, and even some donors who would like a guy like Ron DeSantis to stay in through the mm-hmm. convention. That's not a guarantee that he will. You know, I think he's not necessarily just an ideological being. He did exist in Congress, right?
Right.
So he may decide that he's not going to stay in through the convention. I don't see Nikki Haley dropping out unless there's really some sort of conspiratorial thing going on in the background where she does end up becoming the VP.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how much pick. I buy into that.
Well, you know, I don't assume anything in terms of people's capacity to rationalize anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've rationalized Donald Trump, so why wouldn't we rationalize, you know, him having Nikki Haley as a VP? I mean, in some ways, okay. And I know that some may sound trite and partisan, but you know, really what it comes down to is people are just really, really capable of rationalizing mm-hmm. anything if they need to. And the amount of money that's behind her campaign, I think represents an effort to, if they can't end him, mm-hmm. to control him. You know, part of that is, I don't know what it represents though, ideologically.
Yeah.
Right. I know it represents the Chamber of Commerce wing for mm-hmm. sure. But you know, there's two parts to what people call the establishment
mm-hmm.
over the past 20 years. Reagan made room for the conservative establishment. Mm-hmm. Before that, there wasn't a conservative establishment. It sort of died off. You had very progressive Republicans, and then you had just political animals, and that was basically it. And then he made Goldwater, and then him, they made room for basically the conservative movement because there was no more room in the Democratic Party
yeah.
for it. So they muscled their way in and became a part of the establishment. It was always sort of you fast forward into the 80s and 90s and you know, the Rush Limbaugh mm-hmm. years. You know, the thing he would always harp on is the fact that nobody ever, you know, the establishment would always hate one wing of the establishment hated the conservative wing because, you know, they just assumed that they were the ones that were going to make them lose mm-hmm. all the time. And you know, Rush's thing was like, no, conservatism wins every time it's tried, because that's what the base wants, and you know, that's what, you know, philosophically
mm-hmm.
You know, is more capable of expanding mm-hmm. things. And I don't think he was wrong about that. Especially as somebody who, you know, defines myself as part of the conservative mm-hmm. wing, right? But you know, that's fracturing, and you know, a lot of these interests don't really even know where they are anymore. You know, they don't know how, I mean, we don't have policy platforms anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2016 was the first year that the Republican Party didn't actually pass a platform
mm-hmm.
Because Trump was enough. It was just personality only. And that was sort of the Obama method, right? Obama was just the personality yep. running. So, you know, we've so far just had a string of demagogues, and you know, Biden isn't necessarily a demagogue in terms of his personality, but you know, we all know what he represents in terms of how he's being used. So,
well, he probably needs to be going to a nursing
home. Yeah, I think, yeah, I think as far as, you know, predicting, you know, how this goes, I think people underestimate, just how strong the interests are on multiple sides. I think, and then I think what happens legally speaking, that's the other piece.
That's,
you know, a lot of people that spout off on, you know, Trump, you know, 90 felony charges or whatever they are, you know, they don't necessarily know the ramifications or how that's going to play out.
Even I don't know how that's going to play out.
Even legal scholars don't, right? Even legal scholars don't, because, you know, you can call yourself a constitutional scholar, but it's like, okay, the Constitution is only as good as what we decide to
hold to,
right? So all of these things are being tested and played out in real time. And everybody claims to have precedent, but nobody does, because this is unprecedented. So I don't know what's going to happen. I think the best thing that any candidate could do, if they really believe that that it isn't a given in terms of, you know, his ability to, you know, be on every ballot or run an actual effective campaign, it's in their interest to stay in the race until the very, until the convention.
Fair enough.
Because that's
true.
You never know.
For all we know, I mean, we've seen polls be wrong before. So that's what led to the Democrats and liberal media meltdown in 2016 anyway, when Donald Trump won, because all the polls said that Hillary was going to win. So Donald Trump may be killing it in New Hampshire, but we all, like I said, we all know that polls are not the most reliable way to measure the voter base or the direction the state or country is going. So,
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, like I said, I mean, he could sweep every single state, and I don't think it hurts anything to still have candidates at the convention. So, you know, I think it's sort of a false premise that somehow you're hurting party unity by not dropping out. It's like, what unity? It's like, you know, you've got people that, you know, supporting these candidates that have already basically said they're never going to support Donald Trump. So it's like, you know, I mean, in some ways, just, you know, if you already think you got it wrapped up in terms of, you know, the voters in the primary, and you think it's a given that he's going to win the primary, who cares if the other candidates stay in?
That's true. Well, Mark,
it's
been a pleasure this morning to talk with you, and I'm looking forward to more months, more episodes of recording and talking current events with you. It's going to be fun.
All right. No, I appreciate it. You went easy on me, so
I enjoyed it. Of course. Well, folks, with that said, stay tuned. We'll be back for a short message. But until then, God bless.
This is a reminder that the Biden administration abandoned 9 to 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan. Now, you won't hear about this from the media or any politician for that matter, because the global elite have their own agenda that disregards human life and basic human dignity. So, to the families and individuals that have been affected by this abandonment, know that you have not forgotten. Most Americans, like myself, know, or your loved ones, didn't choose to stay behind. If there's any way I can further help besides bring awareness, reach out at Kenjin_Express. I repeat, Kenjin_Express on Instagram. Spell the word engine, put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, underscore express, if you have by one in a millionth chance hear this message. It's not much, but know this, justice will be served for those who lied to justify their incompetence. After all, I believe in God, who is in control of all things, and he says, vengeance is mine. Now, let's get back to the show.